fundamental physics, at least fundamental particle physics. And a number of problems have received considerable attention in this context, most of which are hierarchy problems. At least at long distances, the question of why the universe is so large is one. And closer to understanding the weak interactions is trying to understand the origin of this of a very large hierarchy between these scales, the weak scale, and the Planck scale. And particularly promising avenues of investigation pertain to low-energy supersymmetry as a possible solution to this hierarchy. And in that context, understanding possible unification of standard model interactions at a high scale, as well as an origin of dark matter. So really, over the last 30 years, starting from the GeV scale, we've been moving to progressively higher energy scales to understand these questions, largely derived from the theoretical successes of the 1960s and 70s. But of course, it's useful to keep in mind, and it's useful to ask the question, and important to ask, what additional ingredients might exist beyond what we discovered in the 60s and 70s through the early 80s. Okay, so in particular, there could easily be additional gauge interactions or other structure that's not directly coupled to the standard model. And it's important to recognize that if that structure exists, you wouldn't expect it to couple directly to the standard model, largely because standard model symmetries forbid most interactions with additional gauge forces and such. Okay? So even though we may have started at the GeV scale, discovered all of this structure, now that we have an operating platform, a theory for describing it, I think we understand now that if there is any additional structure at any scale, the strategy changes a little bit. There's only a limited number of operators that one can consider that couple new gauge interactions or other structure to the standard model. And in fact, for some time now, a number of people have systematically investigated different marginal and relevant operators that one can write down and think of as portals for defining phenomenology to actually look for this additional structure. So those people include Brian Battelle, Maxim Pospelov, Adam Ritz, and others. Now, for the rest of this talk, I want to focus specifically not on all possible types of interactions that the standard model could have, weak interactions with other sectors, but I want to focus specifically on how the standard model can couple to new gauge interactions. So it's been known for some time that, in a simple case, for example, if there's an additional U1 in nature, an additional abelian vector boson, that there is a marginal operator that's allowed by all symmetries, kinetic mixing. This operator can be generated by radiative corrections at any scale, provided there's particles somewhere that carry charges under both the new U1 and our hypercharge. And these radiative corrections can naturally generate a kinetic mixing operator with a scale in the range of 10 to the minus u to 10 to the minus 4. So theoretically, if there are new gauge interactions, you wouldn't expect them, unless they're coupled at tree level, to be terribly strongly coupled. Okay? So this is all fairly straightforward. Once you do this, this physics is equivalent in the case of a mass of U1, which I'll get to in a second. This physics is equivalent to ordinary charged matter in the standard model acquiring a millicharge under these other gauge interactions, under this new U1. Now, for me, the question of radiatively generating kinetic mixing with new U1s, this seems relatively straightforward, relatively natural, can occur at any scale. The question that I care about, though, is what mass scale is associated with these new U1s? Naively, you would say, well, either they're way up at the Gutter-Planck scale or they're massless, if with no additional ingredients added, and if they're super heavy, who cares? If they're super light, there's actually considerable constraints on those kinds of interactions. You could take the attitude that in this dark sector with a new U1, there could be matter in some other non-abelian group that confines, and you could have a technicolor-like sector which Higgs's this U1, and that could happen anywhere, so we can be agnostic about that. What I want to focus on, though, is the weak. Go ahead.
Same thing with the W and gluons.
Kinetic mixing with. So I should say, are you referring to this operator?
Exactly.
So if this operator is allowed by symmetries because these are abelian field strengths. So if we have non-abelian gauge forces, I would need to add additional content. So in particular, if I have I need a source of symmetry break in particular. So if I have bifundamental fields that I can integrate out after I've broken the symmetry at low scales, I could generate this operator, and that changes my numerology for epsilon. For simplicity, though, I just want to focus on the U1 case.
Yeah, but if I don't consider how epsilon was created, if I just put the knowledge for that term, it is consistent with all symmetry, right?
Correct. Yeah, I mean, I could just write down a tree-level term, absolutely. I don't have to. Okay. So what I'm trying to underscore here is that weak coupling to new U1s can arise naturally, but what you should really focus on is trying to understand what mass scale to associate with new gauge interactions. And what I find particularly interesting as a possibility is that the mass scale could be associated with the weak scale, an area that we've explored quite extensively already. But as I've just shown, if there are new gauge forces in this area, you wouldn't expect the couplings to be very large. So how can this happen? So let's go back to a widely popular framework for beyond the standard model physics. Let's assume that low energy supersymmetry exists. Just start there. And let's go ahead and see what happens in a supersymmetric context if new U1s kinetically mix with standard model hypercharge. So here's the supersymmetric version of kinetic mixing. And let's take a very minimal dark sector, and so we'll have a new U1. There should be a prime here. And let's go ahead and add matter field that's charged into this new U1. So we can have a superpotential, say, of this form or of this form. There should be a minus here. So we have charged matter. So these simple toy theories have been considered by a number of authors. And we could make them more complicated if you'd like, but this should illustrate the effect that I'm about to talk about. So this operator necessarily induces, in a supersymmetric context, mixing between the new dark U1 and hypercharged U1 D terms. Okay. So the matter fields, the scalar components of those matter fields, acquire a D term potential in the dark sector. Okay, so these are the dark sector scalar fields. They acquire the following D-term potential. And after electroweak symmetry breaking, the Higgs terms turn into Eliopoulos terms for the dark sector scalars. OK? So this is just, I'm just setting the standard model Higgs fields to their VEV. This is the D-term mixing piece. And there's an epsilon out front. And so this induces an instability in some appropriate linear combination of the scalar fields in this toy example, so that electroweak symmetry breaking necessarily triggers dark U1 breaking. Okay? So all of this is just a simple consequence of kinetic mixing in a supersymmetric context. Now, in this case, the U1 breaking is directly tied to electroweak symmetry breaking, but it's down by a power of this kinetic mixing term, epsilon. Okay, so for the ranges of epsilon that I said were appropriate for a radiative generation of the kinetic mixing term, you'd expect this scale to be in the GEV range, perhaps smaller, perhaps a little larger. So this is a fairly generic mechanism. All we're introducing is kinetic mixing in a supersymmetric context. And if the dark sector has matter fields that can be light, then you should think of this as a minimal contribution to a symmetry-breaking mass term in the dark sector. So what I'm trying to highlight here is that beyond weak coupling to new gauge interactions being natural, a particularly interesting place to look is the same region we started out at 40 or 50 years ago, and it's at the GEV scale. Okay? essentially the mass scale can be tied to electroweak symmetry breaking in very simple examples, in frameworks that support a solution to the hierarchy problem, and so on. So I want to focus on this region here as a good place to explore. And as you'll see, the constraints on this, on new gauge interactions in this mass range, are surprisingly weak. They don't need to be. There's an array of methods for exploring this area. But largely, this subject of systematically exploring the GEV scale with high precision was dropped 20-some years ago. But the instrumentation and beams available for probing this region have improved dramatically in that time. Okay. So that's the theoretical setup for thinking about new gauge interactions at the weak scale. Now, in reality, I think most of the interest in this subject for a lot of people is derived from more of a phenomenological direction, perhaps including myself. Namely, that a series of astrophysics and direct detection anomalies seem to be readily explained if we assumed that dark matter was charged under an additional force. And a natural way of coupling this additional force to the standard model is through kinetic mixing. So in this setup, we can just imagine that dark matter, like we often assume, is a thermal relic at the TeV scale. And the only ingredient we're going to add is that we're going to say that it's charged under a new U1 that kinetically mixes with the photon. So instead of dark matter being some state that carries direct standard model charges over here, it's still a TeV scale thermal relic, but it carries its own force. Now, phenomenologically, this has a number of very interesting consequences, both for dark matter annihilation physics and for direct detection phenomenology. So I just want to touch on a few of these. So first, consider direct detection rates. So as I said, the new U1, as it mixes kinetically with the photon, couples therefore dark matter to charged standard model fields. So this could be a heavy nucleus with charge Z. And in direct detection experiments, scattering would occur through the exchange of an A prime. So the amplitude receives a suppression by epsilon, as well as the charges, and is set by the following. But for this minimal method of mass generation in a supersymmetric context, and this is just for illustrative purposes, the epsilons cancel out, as well as the extra factors of dark coupling. And this is naturally, parametrically, a weak interaction rate. Now, this works parametrically in this simple context. And you should also expect this is true just numerologically if you have mediators at the GEV scale with couplings that are in the realm of weak interaction strength. Okay. So in this case, despite the lack of standard model charge, dark matter in these scenarios can naturally have weak scale scattering rates with ordinary matter.
There's a very accurate low energy direction dictator. Do you use the balance and flavor changing neutral curves, which are very tight and small?
So this does not induce additional flavor changing neutral curves.
Can you rule out this stuff at this level?
There's no flavor changing neutral currents that are effects that are generated through this kinetic mixing operator.
What about fitting electric dictators?
So there are constraints. There are. I'll get to some of those constraints in a bit. They're fairly weak. Let's try this again. Okay. Another important consequence that has received quite a bit of attention is that if dark matter is charged under a new. Yeah. Go ahead.
So this Na prime. This is the mass of this new gauge field, right?
This is the mass scale generated from it.
What is the mass of the photon?
So this is the mass of the physical dark.
No, but the physical photon is not dark.
Our photon,
yes,
is massless.
So, but if you have a such phenomenological kinetic mixing, then it's natural to go to diagonal basis, right? in which bullet fields move massive.
No. Look, there's no effects here that actually...
We're working in mass eigenbases in which actually the propagator is non-diagonal.
Right.
Somehow it's more natural to...
And when you diagonalize, there's still a zero eigenvalue. So there's a linear combination that's massless that is our photon. You should expect that because the symmetry breaking effects that I introduced were in no way charged at all under RU1.
Okay. It's just not an orthogonal rotation because of the, you have to diagonalize the kinetic term, and so you're not just doing a rotation for that. Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit different than the normal diagonalization you normally do.
Yeah.
How do you avoid favorite changes? There's weak interactions.
So you can think of this operator. You can think of this operator effectively just motive. It's a parity preserving operator. It does not induce any new off diagonal flavor components.
But this is an assumption.
Well, no, I can just write this operator down and carry out the procedure of diagonalizing the fermion mass matrix and so on. And no new effects are generated by this operator.
It's not a weak force. It's not like the weak force.
It's not like the weak force, no.
Got it.
Yeah. So another important consequence concerns small scales, much smaller than the dark matter mass scale that can be generated in this context. So if dark matter is charged under a new gauge force that's broken, then mass and wave function renormalization can generate a small splitting of the dark matter state. So in particular, if we imagine that dark matter is just a Dirac fermion, then the Weyl components are split by massive wave function normalization, provided all the custodial symmetries in the theory are broken. And these mass scales can be exceedingly small. Essentially, the radiative splittings are proportional to the custodial symmetry breaking that exists times the power of dark coupling, which is typically itself proportional to the power of the dark coupling. So it's typically two powers of the dark coupling times the gauge mass scale. So this is naturally in the hundreds of keV to an MeV range. Okay. Now, this is important because once these splittings are generated in the dark sector, the direct detection phenomenology is radically altered because there's no longer dominant elastic scattering channels. The vector, once you diagonalize, mediates dominantly off-diagonal scattering between the two split states. Okay, so this has a very strong impact on what direct detection experiments would see looking for dark matter of this form. And in particular, if you ask what experiments would see this kind of effect, what experiments would be most sensitive to inelastic scattering, it's experiments that have very heavy nuclei so that you have so that kinematically you can upscatter, you have enough energy to upscatter. Such experiments, at least one candidate experiment has been reporting a signal consistent with all these features, Gamma Libra, and this is the context in which inelastic dark matter phenomenologically acquired quite a bit of interest. So Gamma Libra is a sodium iodine, well, there's Gamma NAI and then a later version, an upgrade, Gamma Libra. This is a sodium iodine experiment that for over a decade was looking for an annual modulation in their total hit rate. And you would expect that to occur for a dark matter signal, because as the Earth travels around the sun, the Earth moves in and out of the dark matter wind. As a result, the scattering rate is enhanced when you're moving into the wind, and is decreases when you're moving away from the wind. So you expect some annual modulation fraction. Typically, it's expected to be on the order of 2 to 3%. Now, the early data showed a modulation. It was a bit choppy. The statistics were not great. And a later version confirmed the phase of this modulation, which has remained consistent throughout 13 years of running. Now, all of the features of inelastic dark matter scattering appear to be quite consistent with the data. And what are these features? Features are a large modulation amplitude, larger than you expect. So why is that? That occurs because the only component of the dark matter halo that can scatter in these experiments are dark matter particles that are out on the Boltzmann velocity distribution. Okay, you need to have some threshold velocity to have enough energy to upscatter. Okay? So the distribution that you're sampling from is some exponentially falling distribution. And so a small variation of the velocity, which occurs as the Earth travels in and out of the dark matter wind, leads to an exponentially enhanced modulation fraction. So instead of the canonical expectation of 2 to 3%, the expectation for an elastic scattering is that the modulation fraction could be anywhere from 20 to 50%. It could be order one. Another important feature is that this scale, the dark matter mass splitting, shows up in the spectrum. There's a distinctive energy scale associated with the scattering, and so the recoil spectrum has a distinctive shape, which is also, which in fact is consistent with what Gamma Libra has reported. Okay. Now, this experiment, obviously, this is a controversial experiment. It could be wrong. By itself, if this is right, it would be a big deal. There are other experiments that can confirm or refute this on the one-year timescale. But by itself, this kind of data, suggestive of small scales, is certainly motivation to think about dark matter charged under some sort of light force carrier. So I just mentioned that these Higgs scenarios where radiative splitting generates a small scale. There's other classes of theories that also take advantage of new gauge interactions at the GeV scale. So in particular, dark matter could arise as a composite meson in a confined theory. And in that case, hyperfine interactions can give rise to these small scales, hyperfine interactions among the constituents. And so that's another class of theories that implements this inelastic scattering. Another important modification of dark matter phenomenology concerns it's the annihilation properties of dark matter. If dark matter is a thermal relic charged under a new gauge force, then annihilation at low velocities receives a Sommerfeld enhancement. Okay. So this Sommerfeld enhancement is just an additional 1 over v dependence in the annihilation rate. And in addition, the annihilation channels can, there are new annihilation channels that exist into the dark force carriers, which can be quite large. Now, this has received a lot of attention in the context of the Pamela and Fermi cosmic ray spectra. So Pamela, for some time, has reported a steady rise in the positron fraction out to energies close to 100 GeV. And Fermi reported a relatively hard spectrum in the E plus E minus flux out to the TeV range, and then joining with the Hess data and falling off abruptly around the 2 to 3 TeV range. Okay. Now, what's a little odd about this data interpreted as dark matter is that the rates you would need to get the signal strength are larger than the annihilation rates you'd expect if you had a thermal relic. In fact, the rates need to be anywhere from 100 to 1,000 times larger. But that's where the Sommerfeld mechanism comes into play. The Sommerfeld enhancement can give you this additional factor of 100 to 1,000 relative to the thermal annihilation rate so that you can naturally accommodate the rates reported in Pamela and Fermi. Likewise, and of course, this so-called boost factor, this is controlled by the mass of the force carrier. If you want to get a large enough rate, the mass of the force carrier needs to be a GeV or smaller. Okay. Now, when you do that, then you have dark matter, and it can annihilate into these light force carriers. Just kinematically, they come back as standard model leptons and light states. They don't come back in the form of heavier hadrons. And that is important because the antiproton spectra out into the 100 GeV range does not show any sharp corresponding rise. So it explains why you wouldn't expect to see any rise, even if this was annihilating dark matter. Just kinematically, if you want to get a big enough Sommerfeld enhancement to explain the magnitude of this data, then you would need a force carrier that's a GeV or smaller. So then, if your force carrier, if you're annihilating your force carrier, just kinematically it can't decay the protons.
Can't go into quarks.
Doesn't go into quarks. Just kinematically.
Can you say something about the low energy? Like you had this, I think this is sort of part of a discussion not understood. This curve bends up, but the data seems to go. Is this understood now? Or? No, on the Fermi, the light inside.
Here?
Yeah, low energies. Now this purple curve goes up, but this, the data seems to just not.
Well, at some point down here, you have to worry about solar modulation effects. You have to worry about the sun's magnetic field. So there's a point, I mean, I think the energy is a little bit high here. But at some point, you have to worry about that.
Is someone actually worried about that? Because they always show these theoretical versus experimental plots, which are the worst fit ever, right? They just perpendicular
right.
lines. And so is there somewhere in the literature?
People do worry about it, but I mean, I shouldn't comment too much because I'm not an expert on the subject. But of course, one complication is it's not even very periodic. It's like varies from year to year, decade to decade. So it's even just hard to model theoretically and actually account for when you're comparing experiments.
But does that mean that the statement is that there's a under control calculation that really agrees if you do it carefully and no one's showing the plot? Or does it mean that no one really knows how to do the calculation? And
down here?
It can probably work.
Well, down here.
Yeah, down there.
I'm not sure at what point you expect. At some point, there is an expectation that we do know how to calculate the backgrounds, and they should agree with our measurements. That expectation kicks in the tens of GeV range. At some point, and it's still controversial, you have to worry about additional local effects. But I'm not entirely. I think the subject is still open, and I don't know at what point it will be settled or where the crossover is precisely.
What assumptions go into the determination of this theoretical purple curve?
This is largely based on Galprop modeling calibrated on using additional data. Uh-huh. So you should worry about the uncertainties here, and they're quite large. Now, people haven't, I mean, one additional comment I should make before moving on, though, this is a talk by itself, these purple curves. People have looked at the uncertainties in background modeling, and through adjustments in magnetic fields and propagation models, a good fraction of this Fermi spectrum can be fit. The problem has always been trying to explain this rise in the positron fraction. That's not something that happens naturally just through modifying the propagation model.
You can fit the data with astrophysical sources like pulse lines.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean,
not to make sweeping generalizations, but these pulsars would be a bit strange. These are pulsars that would be dumping 30%, half their energy into E plus E minus pairs. They'd have to be relatively close, and they would have to dump their energy in the right time to explain this.
There's a competition between your strange model. That's the physical strange body.
Absolutely.
So which is the strangest?
It's you decide.
For the pulsar model.
Now, in my opinion, though, I mean, fortunately, we don't have to sit around and decide what is stranger. I think we have enough data coming in that the data will settle for us.
And what's the handle? What's the handle for the pulsars? Is it spikiness, or how do you? What would be the deciding?
What you would hope, one thing you would hope for pulsars is to find a corresponding, you would hope to find it in gamma rays. I mean, you'd hope to actually find a candidate source that can do this. Part of the problem is there aren't candidate pulsars that do this very well.
Yep.
That's not to say they're not there, because pulsars, they can dump all their energy in 100,000 years ago, and that's roughly the time scale you want. And then they don't necessarily have to glow in gamma rays. They don't.
Can you keep making alpha T and epsilon smaller and smaller? How do you ever falsify this?
How do you falsify new gauge forces?
Yeah.
Well, the rest of my talk's about that. Okay, so I'm not going to commit at all to these anomalies. I think they some of them may be astrophysics. All of them may be astrophysics. It doesn't really matter. I'm highlighting these features to explain why there's been this subject of new gauge forces has received so much attention in the last year. Theoretically, this subject is very mature, and it's been around for a quarter century. Okay, so actually this slide just says it. Independently, theoretically, this possibility is interesting, and let's just call it timely in light of the astrophysics and direct detection data. Okay. At the end of the day, the data will improve, will help us decide. But even if all these anomalies go away, this question will still remain, and I think is worthy in its own right. OK, so now on to insight from laboratory experiment. So I want to start by providing a survey of all the ways in which collider-based experiments can address this question of new gauge interactions. Many of them are obvious, some of them are not. So let me start by just highlighting this top one here, which I'll talk about at the end. So these are collisions of charged particles off a fixed target, and you can produce new gauge forces through radiative loss mechanisms. Okay, so there's a rich experimental program that can be developed around this that I'll get to. But currently, there's not much data surrounding this in the region that we'd like. There is some from the 1980s looking for axions, which actually set interesting constraints. The second class comes from colliding E plus E minus experiments. So here you can collide charged particles, and you can make, through any sort of weakly coupled gauge interaction, anything underneath 10 GeV or so. So this is supposed to be a very inclusive diagram. So this is an off-shell new gauge force, and anything and everything that it couples to underneath 10 GeV you can probe through this reaction. So X could be standard model leptons. This wouldn't be a very striking signal in that case. Or it could be additional gauge bosons, or dark sector mesons, or so on and so forth. So X is just a generic name. There's a radiative return process. E plus E minus goes to R photon and an on-shell new gauge boson. This is a way of trying to produce new gauge forces on-shell. And then these can decay back into anything that's kinematically accessible to them. Again, X could be a pair of standard model leptons, or it could be anything else that it can decay into. Okay. And the final production mechanism is a bit more indirect, but is appropriate to hadron colliders. I mentioned all of this, both the mass scales and kinetic mixing in the framework of low energy supersymmetry. If that's indeed the case, then that has an impact on the signatures of supersymmetric particle production. And so this leads to lepton jets, which is a subject that I'm not going to touch on, and I'll refer to other people in the literature for that. Okay. So let me go ahead and summarize what the existing data tells us, and then tell you a little bit about the fixed target experiments that can be done on a 1 to 2 year time scale to really help clean up this subject. Okay, so I just told you what these production reactions are. So off-shell pair production of anything that new forces can couple to, and then on-shell production. These are all set by, the cross-sections are all set by epsilon squared over the beam energy. So this tells you you want high luminosity GeV scale colliders. Now, even though the astrophysics and direct detection motivation is very speculative, very controversial, I like to look at it in the context of these collider searches to get some vague idea of the kind of sensitivity one would like to have to make a claim to the effect that new light force mediators can or cannot be responsible for gamma Libra. So this sort of touches on your question of falsification. So how do you do that? So fortunately, the direct detection rates in gamma Libra, I'm trying to show this schematically here, parametrically depend on the same couplings that the production cross sections do in an E plus E minus collider. Okay. So there's, you know, again, a single power of epsilon, ordinary hypercharge and dark sector coupling. The principal difference is that the scattering rates in direct detection experiments are set by the mass scale of whatever the force carrier is, while you just have, while the cross sections here are all controlled by the beam energy. So as a function of mediator mass, so you have a new U1 and some mass scale on the x-axis here. I'm showing it from 100 MeV to 10 GeV. As a function of this mass, if you interpret gamma Libra at face value, then you can derive a value of epsilon that's appropriate for their reported scattering rate and translate that into a production cross-section. And these are the kinds of production cross-sections you find. There is some model dependence here, but for different classes of models, you can make curves like this. And what I want to draw your attention to is that on the high mass side, above hundreds of MeV, current experiments like Babar and Bell and Chloe that have very large data sets on the order of inverse Attobarn are sensitive to a large part of the parameter space in these models. So in particular, I've shown a line here corresponding to about 100 events of light U1 production in an E plus E minus collider at light Babar. And you see that in the region that's of interest for Gamma Libra, the production rates, if anything, could be much, much larger than that. OK? So if I go through
Beta.
Yeah, so let me, yeah, so this is cross-section in femtobarns. And this is just a line corresponding to 100 events from the Babar data set.
And what is the current limits from Babar?
So I'll get to that. The current limits are actually, they depend on the mode. But I'm doing this just to give you an idea that this is not a fruitless place to look. Okay, they should have sensitivity if their analyses can be done in a low background environment. Okay, and again, just to give you an idea of the event rates, we can look at Bell, Babar, Chloe. These all so Bell and Babar are B factories. Chloe's a five factory. Best three, which is coming online, is a J psi factory. Now, here's for candidate couplings of just a dark coupling of order alpha, and let's just take an epsilon of 10 to the minus 2 to accentuate this. Okay, the production rates can be huge, okay, tens of thousands of events. So this should tell you that you certainly have signal potential here. And now the question is, what signals are you looking for? Now, I'm going to go ahead and put up a rather complicated sketch here that you can select pieces from. But the punchline is, you want to look at multi-lepton final states. Okay, so simple production modes are some of those that I showed you earlier. You can make, you could make a single dark photon that goes to L plus L minus. So the simplest search might involve an L plus L minus bump hunt. Another reaction that's interesting, I'll just show it on this side, so forget about the top part, is you can go through an off-shell vector to an on-shell vector through and a Higgs. This is the Higgs-Strelung reaction that these authors highlighted. And this can give you a very dramatic signal. It can give you a six lepton final state. Okay. There's other reactions which just consist of off-shell production of two vectors, and that can give you a four lepton signal, but that's more appropriate for non-abelian models. And then, of course, you can be agnostic, and if the dark sector isn't Higgs, it's confined, you could have a much more complicated cascade and higher lepton multiplicities. So the point here is that the actual signal that you would look for is very model dependent, but you know categorically you're looking at multi-lepton final states trying to do a bump hunt. Now, I'm going to borrow a slide actually from a Slack workshop on this subject a couple of months ago that I think nicely summarizes the current status and the current plans for settling this in E plus E minus colliders. So these are the radiative return reactions up here. And a number of searches have been done in Babar and Bell, but Babar in particular, looking at dileptone resonances in a radiative return reaction. Okay. Now, these searches are all background limited. There's an enormous QED background to these. Okay. And so they, as a result, their sensitivity is impaired. And I'll tell you in a second what it is. Now, a good strategy is to try to find final states that have as little background as possible so you can set tight constraints. So the strategy that was adopted by the Slack group was to actually start in a slightly more non-abelian appropriate channel, which is a four lepton channel, and set constraints there, but then use this as a basis for branching out and very inclusively searching in arbitrary lepton final states. Okay, so currently the Babar group is starting from four leptons and they're branching out to five leptons and higher, which would include this Higgs-Strelung reaction, and they're also including missing energy and vertices, okay, and displaced vertices. So in practice, the sensitivity in these multi-lepton channels can be quite good and is certainly within, certainly is in a theoretically interesting region and is certainly within striking distance of the sensitivity you'd want to make a statement about Gamma Libra. So these are cross-section constraints on the scale of tens of attobarns, and they translate into kinetic mixing coefficients of order 10 to the minus 4. Now, that's for the multi-lepton final states. That's for 4 leptons and more, and we expect similar sensitivity for the searches that involve more leptons. Now, another place to look in E plus E minus collider environments and elsewhere are rare meson decays. So if these new new vectors are lighter than various meson resonances, then there's new decay modes that open up. And so in particular, probably the most sensitive that has yet to be analyzed in great detail is phi goes to eta plus, it's called a U boson here, but plus a new on-shell vector. And then this can go to 2 leptons. So if this analysis is done, this can reach a sensitivity of 10 to the minus 3. You'd like to go further, but that's pretty good. And then similarly, at low mass, you can use Babar, Bell, and KTEV pi 0 data sets to look at EE gamma, where you look for a resonance in EE that has comparable sensitivity. And eventually, BESS using JSI may be able to use 6 lepton channels to probe even lower couplings. So in summary, the existing E plus E minus data sets and rare meson decay sets, if all of the data in the world is analyzed, many of those limits, most of them, sort of most generically come down to the level of a few times 10 to the minus 3. So that's pretty good. You'd like to go further, though, just on theoretical grounds. You'd like to go further as well, just on the grounds that you'd like to be sensitive to gamma Libra. So let me talk about experiments that can push this quite a bit further. So let's consider the fixed target reaction versus the E plus E minus reactions. So first, compare the cross sections. So in an E plus E minus reaction, the cross sections are set by the beam energy, as well as alphas and epsilons. And these are typically of order tens of femtobarns for the range that we've been talking about. In a fixed target reaction, the cross sections are modified in 2 important ways. So the production mechanism is, for example, an electron scattering off a heavy nucleus through a Coulomb photon and then emitting an A prime. This scattering can occur coherently. So the scattering can occur coherently off the nuclear charge. So there's a Z squared enhancement. And the cross section's set not by the beam energy, but it's set by the mass scale of the A prime. So this can be a few orders of magnitude larger, keeping all of the parameters the same. Another very, very important fact is that while the E plus E minus machines have integrated inverse attobarn over the last decade, which is very, very good, the fixed target experiments have an intrinsic advantage because one of the components, what the other, you know, they have an electron beam hitting a fixed material. So that's many more nuclei in the other beam, per se. And so they typically will integrate inverse attobarn per day. Okay, so this is a tremendous luminosity advantage. There's also, let's call it an advantage that that can be derived from unique fixed target kinematics. So in the radiative loss reaction, so now I'm drawing it as the electron beam coming in, it scatters and you make an A prime, and for simplicity, I'm assuming the A prime decays to 2 leptons. Unlike photon bremsstrahlung, the energy spectrum for emitting a force carrier heavier than the electron is tilted at high energy. Typically, these new force carriers will carry away almost the entire beam energy. So they're very forward, and then the decay products are very forward. Okay. Now, this means that when you're building experiments to probe fixed target environments to look for these kinds of reactions, you can build very forward compact detectors. Okay. So you don't have to have 4 pi detectors. There's no need, because all of the beyond just the raw boost factor, there's just the radiative loss kinematics that enhances the forward production. Now, beyond this fact, this is a bit of an interlude. You need to know something about lifetime if you want to build an experiment and go looking in a fixed target environment. Do these force carriers, do they decay promptly, or do they travel some distance before they decay? So this depends on how they're coming back, obviously. So if A prime decays back to the standard model to 2 leptons, if these new force carriers come straight back, then the gamma C taus are as follows. Okay, so they reach sort of millimeter displacements for epsilons around 10 to the minus 4 at 100 MeV. Now, there's other decay modes available. The A primes can decay to dark Higgses, okay, so they can cascade decay a little bit, and then the Higgses can come back. And in that case, the lifetimes are much longer because the lifetimes are controlled by the corresponding dark Higgses coming back to two leptons or more, and those lifetimes are typically much, much, much longer, holding all the couplings the same. Okay, so that's where the model dependence creeps in. Now, so there's a vast territory to cover. Okay, so I'm just going to go ahead and show on this plot a summary of the existing constraints from G minus 2, as well as a Babar constraint here. There may be a few that, that if data is analyzed, you may fill in this region a little bit up here, down to a, you know, a couple 10 to the minus 3. Now, what I've shown here, so this is epsilon, this is the mass. What I've shown in gray dotted lines are, is I'm going to call this the just the kind of the power bill limit, okay? In order to produce new force carriers with smaller epsilons, you'd have to have a phenomenal amount of power in beams to produce anything at any reasonable rate. So let's just call this the technological limit. But in here, there's quite a range of lifetimes, of production cross-sections, and so on. So this is a huge territory. Now, a lot of it has been explored through experiments that looked for axions in the 1980s and early 1990s, so-called beam dump experiments. And the way these worked is that an electron beam would be slammed, they were slammed into thick targets with thicker shielding. So all of the beam remnants were stopped in these shields. And then any axions or force carriers or the like that can be produced that are weakly interacting then fly through the shield. And they can decay in a very long region, a sort of a decay volume that was typically ranged from 50 centimeters to 100 meters, so it could be very long. And then typically scintillator detectors were placed downstream that would look for electronic decay products. So these experiments dumped tens of coulombs of electrons. Okay, so you should expect them to be quite sensitive, and indeed they were. So I'm showing in this plot electron beam dump constraints on new light force carriers. There's analogous constraints that are very similar for proton beam dumps. They all have a characteristic shape. So I'm showing here, this is a slack experiment, E137. So they all have a lower boundary corresponding to the lifetime extending beyond the decay volume by too much. And then they have a diagonal boundary that corresponds to the lifetime being smaller than the thickness of the shield. So the decay happens in the shield. Okay? So they all have this characteristic shape. Now, this is for new force carriers decaying back to dileptons. And what I want to highlight here is this vast open region, which, as I'll show in a moment, is precisely the region that corresponds to gamma. There's a band here that corresponds to the gamma-Lieber region. And then, of course, the theoretical region of interest is between, say, 10 to the minus 3 down to 10 to the minus 4 or smaller. So there's a large range here that is unexplored, theoretically motivated, and certainly interesting in the context of other data sets. Let's see. Of course, you can interpret these beam dump constraints in other ways. I showed you interpretation for two lepton decay modes. But you can imagine other decay modes. You can these light vectors can decay to dark sector Higgs states, pseudoscalar or otherwise. You can have Higgstra-Lung reactions. So for these, for a number of reasons, proton beam dumps turn out to be slightly better, mainly for instrumental and collimation reasons. And so essentially what happens is all of those triangular regions shift to the upper right when the lifetime gets longer for the same couplings. So there's model-independent ways of interpreting these bounds as a function of lifetime and epsilon squared times branching ratio. Essentially, the beam dump constraints look like curves on this plot, where everything above the curves is ruled out. And then a typical model will give you particles with lifetime as a function of epsilon. And so the region that runs through here would be ruled out. So I'm not going to synthesize all of this for you right now. I'll show you one example looking at scalar decay modes in the context of CHARM. So whereas the earlier excluded regions were down here, off the plot, they all shift to the right when the lifetimes are longer. Okay, so the CHARM beam dumps set constraints at rather large values of epsilon. And there's another kind of amusing beam dump experiment, if you will, that consists of the sun as the dump. So as I've often been alluding to, if dark matter is charged into these new force carriers and is annihilating into them, if that's what's explaining, say, Fermi or Pamela or the like, then necessarily, if the sun captures dark matter and dark matter annihilates in the core, I mean, the sun's just a cooker now, these final states, if they have a long lifetime, can get out of the sun, right? They're weakly interacting, they're long-lived. So now you have a baseline of an AU where the decay can happen. And the instruments are the satellite experiments like Fermi, Milagro, and others. And based on their observation of charged particles from the sun, you can derive roughly constraints in this mass and epsilon space. And so in a simple model here for A primes going to scalars, you see constraints that look like this, that actually do live in the theoretically region of interest. And the Damalieber region cuts right through this region right here. Okay. So these types of experiments, these beam dump in spirit experiments, do set rather strong constraints. So we already know quite a bit about new gauge interactions that may weakly couple to us. And if I had to summarize, I would say that there's a number of experiments that should be done to look at very long-lived decays that consist of these new force carriers decaying to scalars or pseudoscalars, and that should be pushed. But in my opinion, those types of decays are fairly heavily constrained. That territory has been explored quite a bit. The territory that has not been discovered, that has not been explored in nearly the same detail, are situations where these force carriers just come back to the standard model. They don't cascade decay. There's nothing complicated. You make these new these vectors, and they come back and die lepton modes. Okay. I told you that the colliding beam experiments, they run out of steam at a few times 10 to the minus 3. They're not sensitive enough to get into this region that is theoretically interesting, and they're not sensitive enough to quite get to the Damalieber region if the decay mode is into dileptons. Okay. So let's return to dileptons and just ask, well, how do we go ahead and attack this region? So now I'm reinstating. This is the band that corresponds to mass as a function of epsilon for the D-term mixing. It's also roughly the band for Damalieber. How do we get this? So one way, relatively straightforward way, is to actually extend some of the earlier beam dumps, but using thinner shields. So for this, you need to use, I mean, essentially, you can drop the shielding down to 10 centimeters or smaller, and you can immediately start probing this territory here. And actually, there's a number of available beams. The instrumentation is still a question, but there's beams at JLab. There's the free electron laser at JLab, which would actually be appropriate for this region down here. There's an interesting beam dump at Duke, which we have not had a chance to investigate in any detail, but they look particularly appropriate for doing an experiment that probes this region. Okay, so just the beam dump experiments. It doesn't compete well with the sun, is what we found. Okay. So you want to move beyond beam dumps. So the only way to do this is you need to move to thinner targets, very thin targets, because as you start removing the shielding, more of the beam remnants get through. And you can't really put an instrument downstream of a beam very well. You'd fry your instrument. So you need to go to a thin enough target that the beam remnants don't just explode in your face and essentially melt the instrument. And then you need, you essentially have two strategies at your disposal. You can do a resonance search, and you can do a vertex and recoil tagging search. You look for displaced vertices.
Did you look at Jupiter?
We did not look at Jupiter, no.
You guys look at Jupiter?
You can get some sensitivity from Jupiter. Depends on basically if the lifetime is of where Jupiter radius or sun radius.
Right, it seems like you would get some region that would be cut out this time.
Right, exactly. So probably more detailed analysis could be done with Jupiter.
Yeah.
I think you lose with Jupiter because it's actually further than sun.
Yeah.
So Jupiter is actually further than sun. of the Earth. So in this case, plus.
Or comparable, it's common.
Yes.
I mean, if you're, the only place they could conceivably help is if the baseline is already passed an AU, where there's some benefit to getting a little bit.
Yeah.
That's the only idea. That's the only place. So moving in the direction of thin targets, this is a design of an experiment. Well, yeah, let me just go through it. So what you want is a thin target, an intense electron beam, and then you want instrumentation very close to the target, away from the center line so the beam can continue through so you don't fry the target. And you want to do bump hunting and vertex tagging. Okay, so there's a number of qualities that are needed for this kind of approach. These experiments, these are known as sort of two-arm spectrometers. These kinds of experiments were done a long time ago. Many QCD resonances were found this way. But the degree of precision that was achieved in those earlier experiments was not nearly what you can achieve now and what you would need to achieve. Okay, so there's two experiments that with a time scale of 2 to 3 years or less, most appropriate for JLAB. So first let me mention there's a heavy photon search working group. So this is a large collection of SLAC experimentalists got interested in trying to just settle this issue by putting together a cheap experiment largely with existing materials, silicon, for example, borrowed from Atlas and Tevatron manufacturing at SLAC. D0 manufacturing, magnets that are lying around, just spare parts, okay? So they're trying to build an experiment that's targeting this kind of physics on a short time scale. Now, unfortunately, SLAC doesn't have an appropriate beam for a variety of reasons. The appropriate beam that exists is at Jefferson Lab, the CBAF beam that can run up to 6 GeV. So they have 3 collider halls. And this group here has moved quite a ways towards designing a parasitic experiment. So this is a slide, now outdated, from this SLAC Dark Forces workshop, showing a schematic of what this looks like. So essentially, there's in Hall B at JLab, there's an existing nuclear physics experiment it's a detector called CLASS. And there's an electron beam that comes in and actually produces photons off a thin target. And the photons go into CLASS for their experiments. And then the electrons are diverted down to a beam dump. But there's a bunker here. Okay, so there's a space to put a new experiment using the primary electron beam. So that's what they're doing. And essentially, they're using silicon and magnets for bump hunting and vertex reconstruction, good acceptance, good resolution. So this experiment, I think the time scale for this is not short. This is, at least a year. Okay, but they're moving in the direction of building something. What's nice about this is that even though it was designed for a dedicated 2-lepton analysis, this kind of experiment can do all kinds of, more than just dark force precision physics. So for example, there is a state in the standard model, orthodimuonium, or true muonium. Okay? It's just a muon atom. We all know it exists. It's never been discovered before. It has all the quantum numbers of an A prime. Mixes kinetically with the photon, and is produced in a very similar way. So that would be used as a calibration candle in this kind of experiment. And it would be the first such experiment to achieve a needed degree of precision. Now, there's a much shorter time scale possibility at Jefferson Lab in their Hall A. So they have existing spectrometers. So this is equipment that's just there. Nothing needs to be built. It's just a question of getting beam time and moving the spectrometers to the right orientation. So there's a proposal currently undergoing internal review before it's reviewed by JLab for 24 days of beam time to explore a region roughly from 50 MeV up to 500 MeV. And the current configurations get us down to a sensitivity of 3 to 4 × 10⁻⁴. We think at the end of the day, the sensitivity will be better than that. There's a number of tricks that have not been exploited. But this is a traditional spectrometer experiment. There'll be a thin tungsten wire target, and then there's magnets that bend the outgoing electrons and positrons into the spectrometers, and then you just do a straight bump hunt, and then you can also do a vertex hunt, but the vertex resolution is not very good. So this should also be the first fixed target experiment that I'm aware of that's actually moving into the region of theoretical interest, close to the region appropriate for gamma. Okay, so in summary here, I'm not going to show a big composite plot that includes all existing data. But let me start by just mentioning the B factories. So the B factories are coming from larger epsilons and especially higher masses, where they're, I think, most uniquely powerful. And in dileptons, they run out of steam up here. And that's really the best terrain for the fixed target experimental program. And in multi-lepton channels, they should be able to push into the region of interest. And then the current fixed target effort is centered around an experiment that Slack is pushing, as well as a JLab possibility that targets, I'm sort of showing the Hall A region here in brown and the Slack region here in pink, or that's red-ish purple. There's another proposal by an MIT and Berkeley group targeting this low-mass region, and then a short baseline beam dump to get this. Now, I'm putting the Gamma Libra region of interest, and this is hard to do perfectly because in a lot of models it's actually up here a little bit, but I'm going to go ahead and be conservative just to show you where you'd really like to push to really settle this. You'd really like to get down here. You want to go all the way. And the current experiments, it doesn't look like they can do it with what's currently being talked about. So part of the reason for that is just that we want these experiments that are being designed are being built on the cheap and quickly. They don't use pixel tracking. Their acceptance is limited. You can't, just because there's very limited silicon. But with improved acceptance, and especially pixel tracking elements, this region here, which is a vertexing region, walks that direction. And this region here walks that direction. So it could be the case, you could think of these as just first generation, and then you can keep pushing this direction if there's reason to. Okay. So between this and B factories, I think these kinetic mixing portals will be rather exquisitely probed on a 2 to 3 year timescale with any luck. Okay. So I think that's interesting, certainly in light of theoretical motivation and just phenomenological motivation from existing data. And it's especially exciting to me because there's, on a decent time scale, a lot of opportunities for experimental progress to really go back to the GEV scale, the place where a lot of modern particle theory started, and really go through and with a high level of precision clean up our understanding of what kinds of additional forces or interactions may exist there. Okay, thank you.
Your slide up again. One of your things with the like that, but we had charm at the very top. It was one of the first times you showed us that.
This one.
Yeah. So when you discussed this one, you'd said what the gamma region of interest was on this one, and I had the impression when you showed this that it went through the area that was being excluded already. So where on this plot would the gamma Libra?
Yeah. So this is. So the constraints from beam dumps are a bit model dependent. The gamma Libra region of interest, or the D-term region, that's not so model dependent, right? Because that's just coupling as a function of mass.
Right.
But how you interpret these constraints is, so this is a plot where you're making new force carriers in the dump, beam dump, and then they're decaying to scalars or pseudoscalars, which, and those in turn have a very long lifetime. Okay, so I first showed these constraints in the context of dileptons decay modes. So that's these. And that's what I showed at the end. So these are dileptons. These are A primes that go straight back to two leptons.
Right.
And so they have long lifetimes at low epsilons down here, on 10 to the minus 5, 10 to the minus 6. And so that's where these constraints are. If the A prime decays into a scalar, then for epsilons of 10 to the minus 3, 10 to the minus 4, they have the same lifetime as would an A prime going to two leptons has down here. So all these constraints shift up.
Well, why is that? So when you say scalar, you mean this is just a spin zero?
For example, whatever Higgs state is giving mass to the A prime.
So what's the difference?
Why is it longer?
Yeah.
Because the decay back to the, there's no direct, the kinetic mixing operator does not directly induce a tree level Higgs goes to two standard model leptons.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
That either goes through a loop or it goes through two off shell A primes to four leptons.
Okay, I'm with you.
So you have to pay four powers of epsilon in the lifetime instead of two.
Okay.
Are there any other questions?
Yeah, just one. that you know. These are all non-experiments. Eventually get smaller and smaller. Eventually. Unless you see something. So, you kind of falsify this stuff in a sense.
Well, I am not going to claim that you can falsify dark matter, that the possibility that dark matter is charged under a new gauge force. Because that gauge force might not couple to us at all, right? So never mind that. But if any of these direct detection experiments can detect scattering, and there's a rate, then you have a line, right? You have a line like this. And you know that if you get past this, you're done. You either find something or you don't.
Dash line.
Yeah, this gray region here.
This
dash line is our best estimate and it could vary up or down a little bit of current sensitivity with existing equipment, existing beams rather.
So you can't get
below that. I think you need a new beam to get below this bottom line. You need with existing equipment. I think you can do this. Okay, what's shown here, where I'm showing the red. You need slightly better equipment to fill out this region, the gray band. But in that sense, you can falsify direct detection possibilities. But of course, right, dark matter could be a singlet under the standard model, charged under dark force, doesn't talk to us at all, and then it's always a possibility.
In your slide with where you have the two green curves, one of which was like blue green, maybe you show us it. Okay, you go back a couple slides. That one, yeah. So what are the two bottom lobes of the gray areas? One of them is almost overlapping the...
This one.
That one and the one above it.
So this gray lobe is the E137 experiment. Huh? It was a slack beam experiment for axions. This was our estimate of supernova constraints. I didn't mention those at all in the talk.
87A?
Yeah. Okay.
Any other questions? All right, well, let's thank Philip again. Visiting until I think Thursday or Friday.